seeing to see how all of this plays out in the courts and what kind of recourse the town of Mosher gets. So, yeah, oh, well, look at that. It's 11:29. We're all out of time, but I would like to thank you for joining me here live in Studio 2. This has been Nate Caleb, and he's, well, not working. He's working with 350pdx.org. That's 350pdx.org. You can find out more about their campaigns that they're working on right now. And so, stay tuned for what's coming up next here on KBOO. It's Madness Radio at 11:30. I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. I'm your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Grainne Humphreys. Grainne is joining us from West Cork, Ireland. She is a psychiatric survivor, a writer, a mother, and she's an activist for a family member, John, who's been incarcerated for many years and diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. She's been leading campaigns on his behalf. So welcome to Madness Radio, Grainne Humphreys.
Hi, Will. Lovely to be here.
It's great to have you. And you are someone who yourself has been involved in the system. And also, you're also a family member who's been really campaigning in Ireland, both on behalf of your former partner, John, who we're going to be hearing about. Also, you've been a leading voice in Ireland for system reforms and changes in the mental health system and very much involved in the movement for mental health reform and critical of psychiatry there. Maybe we should just get started with telling us about your own story. How did you yourself become involved with the mental health system?
Well, when I was 27, I came home from London. Well, I was put on a plane because I was having a massive mental breakdown. I had been using drugs as well, like ecstasy and cocaine. I had been in a punk rock indie underground band. I'd been living the high life. Well, I'd been working very hard too. I had got myself involved with a boyfriend as well who had been influencing me. You know, we'd been partying and it hadn't been a very good scene, really, towards the end. I was put on a plane and came home in an awful state.
So you weren't eating and you were sleep deprived and you were just really in a really difficult place.
I was in a very difficult place, and some of it my own making, you know. I was very driven and very ambitious at the time, and our band was starting to become quite recognized in indie circles. We had a following, and Melody Maker were doing some reviews on us, and we had record label interest. I basically went mad before I cut the album and did the tour. It was like I had put all of my eggs in that basket in making an album and being in a band, and I didn't have any plan B. And when I got home, I was absolutely terrified. I didn't realize what was happening. I was basically unraveling. Everything was speeding up. I didn't sleep for 3 months. I screamed. I must have been terrifying to my younger siblings and my family. My mother didn't take me to a hospital for months. She and some friends, some sort of elder women, very wise women, minded me through this horrendous experience I was having, which was partly drug-induced and partly breaking down of my ego, I would say. I was having a huge breakthrough. I was told that this was a transformative experience, that I would grow through it, that I would become a wounded healer, perhaps, that I would become a stronger person because of it, and that my life would be better. I got all those messages very early on, and I got an awful lot of love, a very tolerant, loving family and community and friends.
And what was it that really drove you into this state? Was it really the drugs, getting involved with ecstasy and cocaine, or was it also something that was going on inside of you, some kind of internal conflict? Because you said your identity changed, you went through a transformation, an ego death.
I think the drugs were only a minor part of what happened to me. I think fundamentally, I was needing to sort of shed my skin and go through this experience in order to mature and to grow. My mother left my father when I was 6 years old, and I think that had a profound impact on my life.
So when you came back from London, you weren't working, people were taking care of you, and you were in a pretty wild state. You were yelling, you weren't communicating. What was that like, being in that state, and how did you interact with people around you?
The one word I would use for being in that state was terror. I may have seemed frightening to people who were outside of me, but inside me was the most terrifying place to be. I just wanted to run, because I was sort of drawn to death, yet terrified of it. But really, it was the ego death. I actually didn't want to die because I was so terrified. Death seemed the only way out, but I couldn't do it, thankfully.
And so the people around you were really tolerating and supportive and giving you a sanctuary. But when you had the suicide attempt, that was really too much for them. That's when you went into the hospital. And you said it was an ego death experience. What was it in you that was dying, and what was it that was being transformed?
What was dying was this young maiden as well, I suppose, innocence, and this kind of, this ambition and this idea that I had to achieve.
Because you were really on the brink of becoming a rock star, or at least in your mind, you were on the brink of wanting to be a rock star. And so you let go of that.
I let go of that, and that was very painful. The band was kind of a place where I was very happy because I was kind of in control of the creative process. I really enjoyed writing songs, and the singing was quite sort of freeing. But I think primarily I'm introverted and quite sensitive, and it was all too much for me, this outward expansion. I think I deviated from my true self. I became this person that I wasn't, and I think that was what was dying. What was lovely about my breakdown was that all my family grew with it, and we all became closer.
How did you get out of the hospital and then start to move into and through the transformation?
It was 3 years it took me to fully recover, and I was given that time, and I was given a lot of love as well. This woman took me into her life, and I was really blessed with her because she spoke the language of breakdown. She spoke in metaphor. I even got to meet a Tibetan Lama at her house, and she really told me, you know, you're going through a baptism of fire, and they gave me so much space and time. I had a spiritual experience where I just felt the universe supporting me. I felt a comforter. I felt a warmth. And I spent most of my time out in nature. And the nature was very healing. I just slowly healed. I actually met my daughter's father then. Having my daughter, thankfully, I was fully recovered and very grounded at this stage. And having her really, I had her at 30, and it just set me on a whole new path. I have to say I'm on a fulfilling and rewarding path now. My children have different fathers because my daughter's father, he left me, and that was fine. It took me 2 years to get over that, but, you know, I was strong enough. I met John at Future Forest, which is a lovely place in West Cork. It was instant attraction with both of us. I had been out of a relationship and raising a child on my own for 2.5 years. Early on in the, you know, when we were talking, I said, well, you know, I had a breakdown, and I could see he visibly relaxed. He said, oh, I've had one of those as well. He was my age backwards at the time. I was 32 and he was 23, so we had a bit of a joke about that. But so he seemed much older than his years. I was yet to find out how much he'd been through. He'd been through an awful lot as a child and as a young man and a young adult.
And he went on to have his own problems after that with the mental health system that ended up getting him incarcerated.
Yeah. Shortly after I met him, I realized that he was actually having a huge experience himself. he actually thought he was Jesus. So he was having the messianic experience. He was having a hugely meaningful and transformative experience himself. And I recognized that. I knew enough from my own experience that, you know, you get through these things and you come out stronger. I supported him for a few months, and then I became exhausted because he was not sleeping. He was up at night, and he was preoccupied with this battle between good and evil. Years later, when I discovered more about these transformational crises, I was astounded at the similarity in experiences, the sort of apocalyptic end-of-the-world experiences, black and white, a fragmenting of one's ego, I suppose. I'm not sure if that's the right word. Basically, he was having some kind of a breakthrough. He needed loads of support, but he was terrified to go back into the hospital because he'd been involuntarily detained before and forced medicated. The first time he was taken to hospital, he was held down by six. This is before I knew him, held down by six nurses, psychiatric nurses, and injected. So he was absolutely terrified, and I didn't know any of this at the time. So I went to his mom and his brother saying, I can't cope anymore. John is, he's really, you know, losing it, and I'm losing it because I'm not getting any sleep. So I was kind of very on my own with John. I had no support, really. Friends were frightened. My family were frightened too, probably, and probably didn't want me to be involved. There was a lot of prejudice around John because in his family, his father was very violent. They were, I suppose, a very disadvantaged family in some ways, in that they didn't have a lot of support themselves. So all quite tricky stuff, difficult stuff. And I realized quite quickly, quite early on, that people who are coming from this kind of a disadvantaged background really get very poor care. They get a very different experience to someone coming from a privileged background. And this is probably quite a controversial and difficult thing to speak about, really, because I think it's quite hidden in our society in many ways. People who go into the mental health system haven't got, say, an empowered and educated parent going in and fighting for you. They can actually get lost in the system. They can become owned by the system and handed over to the system. And then the system does what they want with them, like over-medicate them for years on end, break their spirit. I mean, really, it's absolutely shocking. I was absolutely appalled by what I saw and by what I have gone through and how really the system or the psychiatric system seems to violate the rights of these people who maybe haven't got the same opportunities. I called his brother and his mother, and his mother has had to sign him in before, and it's not something she wanted to do. She didn't feel that she could support him because she has a lot on her plate, so she signed him in.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We're speaking to Grainne Humphreys, who lives in West Cork, Ireland. She's a writer, a mother, and herself a psychiatric survivor, and a family member of a man who's incarcerated in Ireland and diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, who she's been campaigning for the release of for many years. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
I had found out I was pregnant as well with my and John's child. I was also trying to hold down a job and raise my daughter. I was in an awful state. I was trying to hide all this from my family as well. I was trying to say everything's fine, putting a brave front on. I remember sitting in the corridor at the hospital, and there was a circle forming around John, and they were trying to get him to comply and take this medication. And I was sitting outside of the circle on the side, and I just felt like Judas to his Jesus. Sorry.
Wow, you're really brave for telling this story. Thank you for, this is a story that needs to be heard.
Yeah, it's like I feel I betrayed him. He told me how frightened he was to go back in, and I just didn't want to have to deal with this anymore. And even though I knew what he was having was a hugely meaningful experience. But what I didn't realize back then was quite how we call it the chemical crucifixion. And I actually recently discovered an artist, a fantastic artist, who did a piece that blew me away called The Chemical Crucifixion. And it was a crucifix with a hands and syringes in it. And actually, John was, I feel he went through some kind of a chemical crucifixion. And I didn't realize that that was going to happen to him. It's almost like I didn't believe him that it could be that bad. And then when I actually saw it, when I saw and what I've seen over the years of what's happened to him, it's just, it's unbelievable.
Wow, and you didn't have any alternatives or any kind of other supports to really turn to, and you didn't realize what was happening.
There is no alternative support here. But this is the activist's journey now, in that I had to connect up with people then who were as outraged by this as I was. In a very significant meeting, I met Mary Maddock of Mind Freedom Ireland. He got transferred up to Carrigmore. Carrigmore is a maximum security. It's a huge red brick building. It was featured on Behind the Walls, which was a documentary recently televised here, with John's story in it. It's set up on a hill overlooking Cork City. It's near some housing estates, and ironically, there's a golf course around it. I walked around to the front of it once with John on a day out, and I was horrified to see that the windows are mirrored, so you can't actually see in. It's a horrible place. It's like a prison. So the first time I went to see him in that locked visitor's room, this person was brought to me through the door by a psychiatric nurse and was absolutely drugged up to his eyeballs. And I couldn't believe it. He was so drugged. And I think over the years, I became desensitized to that then.
What were they saying about him that they decided to put him in this maximum security incarceration and drug him so much?
They didn't really communicate with me. This is part of my campaigning as well, is that families are absolutely excluded. I remember I've written letters about what I think John's issues are, and I feel I was just given lip service, because all he was given was drugs, and it's just like a maintenance model. It's just drugs, drugs, and more drugs.
And so they diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, which is probably the worst diagnosis that you can get.
Yeah, let's leave you on the backwards diagnosis, kind of. Let's just forget about you. You'll never get better. At first I thought, well, I'll check out what they're saying. And I looked on these online websites about, these medical ones. And I immediately, my gut just went, what a load of rubbish. It didn't make any sense. This medicalization of it. In a way, I think these experiences, if you look at them in the context of people's lives, they're actually a very creative response to trauma, and they make sense. They're kind of common sense if you deconstruct them and find the pieces of the puzzle. And John is a very gifted writer, and he speaks in kind of poetic metaphor a lot of the time, which he'd make a very good writer of prose.
But that probably is also seen as a sign of his illness if he's too poetic.
Everything. They'll pathologize your cat, if you let them. They pathologize everything. I mean, you can't win in this game. I had never encountered such arrogance. And the way I see it now is that he's institutionalized, and he is under their spell. He's in the twilight zone. He's caught in a victim-perpetrator dynamic that is like a circle, and he's caught there. Releasing him to that has been so painful, because it's the loss is almost too much to bear. What I notice when John has his depot shot, which is an injection of clopidogrel, which is a slow release of a medication into his system, often used for patients who are deemed non-compliant with taking their medication. What I've noticed as it wears off is that he becomes more vocal about his rights. And they view that as him being unwell, because he's speaking about his rights. And then when he's back on the depot shot, I won't hear from him for a few days because he's sleeping it off. I mean, I can't believe this is happening in 21st century Ireland. I can't, because it's such a violation of human rights. You could get burnt out fighting it. What we have to do is look at alternatives and look at ways forward.
It sounds like what you're describing is that he's really lost his personality. He's under kind of a chemical punishment.
I have a very good example of an insight that I gained one day about how the system operates. I had been invited to go to a major review for John, and a major review is when the consultant psychiatrist and the head psychiatric nurse and basically team members of John's medical team come together with the carers and or the family members and to talk about John. John had been invited, but he declined to come because I think he finds that kind of setup quite intimidating because of what he's experienced in the locked unit. So he had been making a jacket out of his trousers. Basically, he's been quite creative with what he had in the hospital, which is very little. So they said, could you tell him to stop doing that? So after the meeting had ended, I went down the stairs and down to the corridor and into the locked visitor's room. And John was brought in, and he had the most amazing trouser jacket on that he'd made. It was so creative and so coordinated and so well made. And I just thought, wow, that's amazing. And then I remembered, oh, I was meant to tell him not to do that. And then I had this sort of insight that it's like accountants trying to understand artists. They're two different breeds of people. I need to talk a little about the physical state of John because it's shocking. After a prolonged sort of media and political campaign, I was able to get John out for 6 hours one day. And out in the sunshine, out in the world, you know, he hadn't been out for 2 years. It hit me, the full horror hit me like a ton of bricks.
He hadn't been outdoors in 2 years?
2 years. And I took him to a park in Cork, Fitzgerald's Park. He couldn't walk far. He was breathless. He had to sit down all the time. All his teeth are black and he's lost a few front ones and his gums are all swollen. He's kind of got a grey pallor. And he was wetting himself. He's incontinent.
And how old is he?
29 at this stage when I took him out that time. I took him back to the hospital that evening. And I drove home myself and I had to pull over the car to cry because it was like the full horror hit me, just how chemically damaged he was or is. It was like an awakening the following day in that I realized before I had seen and I'd known mentally what was going on with him, but it was the first time that I really felt in my body the grief at what had been done to him in the name of care. I howled and howled the whole of the next day, and I was in an awful state, kind of processing not just what has happened to John, but what has happened to millions of people worldwide with this psychiatric drugs and this forced treatment. It's just so wrong. It's like a Holocaust. I think it's like I often make that analogy that it's our Holocaust. That day was like a full impact. It hit me, just what had been done to this man, this beautiful, talented, and creative man.
And Grania, tell us about the campaigning that you've done, the activist work that you've done to try and pressure the system both to release him and treat him like a human being and also to change the system there in Ireland.
Well, there's been a number of people who've really helped me on that path. Peter Bullimore had of Hearing Voices Network and Brian Hartnett of Hearing Voices Ireland had encouraged me to write. And it was thanks to Jane O'Carley then, who I connected up with on Beyond Meds. And she really laid the first block in the foundation for the campaign for the incarceration of John by publishing the piece I'd written. And then over the years, I came to the attention of Elemental UK, which is an English activist group. Elemental UK, Marion Aslan and Mike Smith, and they made a campaign video also called The Incarceration of John, which you can find on YouTube. eventually our story came to the attention of John McCarthy of Mad Pride Ireland, and he was instrumental in breaking our story in Ireland, really first in with the Cork Independent, and John's story was front page, psychiatric prisoner. From there, really it's just grown, and there's a growing movement in Ireland, and the Irish Critical Network is a really thriving network of people from diverse backgrounds who want to challenge psychiatric power in Ireland and also, you know, explore alternatives to the current biomedical model.
And tell us, what is the vision that you have and this movement has, both for how John should be treated and also just changing the system in general?
Well, I think that we need to be looking at the open dialogue model, which was pioneered in Western Lapland, or Western Finland, sorry. I believe that if we had a sort of more a family therapy lens, so that when an individual, distressed individual presents, that their experience is not medicalized, but it is viewed in the context of the entire family system, and also that the family are involved and the distressed individual is supported in growing through this experience. I think we need to be looking at that model here, and we need to be moving away from medicalizing distress.
Yes, open dialogue is a really innovative approach, and we've actually done an interview about open dialogue that people can listen to with Mary Olson. Grania, we don't have a lot of time left, but tell us, what is the status with John now? Is he still being held at Carrigmore, and how is he doing, and what's going on with his situation now?
Well, John is trying to keep his spirits up. He is due to be transferred to Dundrum, which is in Dublin, but that hasn't happened yet, and we're in the dark as regards that. He continues to be in a state of, you know, he's still medicated. His issues have not been not addressed at all. There actually isn't a psychotherapist, even in a psychologist in the centre. He continues to pace up and down the corridors and live in a locked maximum security facility, and he really doesn't need to be there, but he's managing to survive. There's a petition that you can sign, the End Force in Irish Mental Health petition, decriminalise human emotions. It's a movement here we're trying to sort of end force.
How can people find out more information about the situation with John and also get involved with the campaign for his release?
Right. Well, there's a blog I've done called The Incarceration of John, and you can find it on freejohn-loverevolutionary.blogspot.com. There's also a Mad Pride Ireland End Force petition that you can sign as well if you just go to the Mad Pride Ireland website.
And how can people get in touch with you if they want to get in touch with you through the blog?
I do the blog through the blog or through Facebook. If people want to write to me on Facebook, I'm Grania Quick Humphreys.
Grania Humphreys, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you so much, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Grania Humphreys. She's a psychiatric survivor, a writer, and a mother, and she's an activist on behalf of her former partner, John Hunt, who's been incarcerated for many years and diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia in Ireland. That's all the time that we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, June 6, 2016. In local news, Portland officials admitted on Sunday that several city park facilities tested positive for high lead levels in the water supplies and the city failed to mitigate the problem and also failed to notify both the public and the management at the individual buildings that tested positive for high lead levels. At the Multnomah Arts Center, 6 out of 11 samples tested positive for lead at levels above the legal drinking water limit established by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The building offers public art classes and houses a preschool. Federal law sets a limit of 15 parts per billion of lead in drinking water. If more than 10% of tap water samples exceed lead levels of 15 parts per billion, then water systems are required to be mitigated to reduce the lead levels. During testing in 2013 at the Multnomah Arts Center, more than 50% of water samples showed illegally high lead levels of lead. A drinking fountain at the center tested at 62.5 parts per billion, more than 4 times over the legal limit. Water from the kitchen tested at 58 parts per billion. Mike Abatee, who has been director of the Portland Parks and Recreation since October of 2011, has admitted that he failed to notify both Commissioner Fritz, who oversees the Parks and Rec Department, and the individual managers of the buildings. The disclosure comes on top of recent news that the Portland Public School District also knew of high lead levels in drinking water supplies and also failed to mitigate the problem. Earlier this year, an Associated Press database study revealed that Portland had the highest average levels of lead in drinking water out of the 75 largest municipal water providers in the United States. The relatively low pH levels of the Portland Bull Run water supply make it highly susceptible to leaching lead from older plumbing. It is estimated that more than 40,000 houses in Portland have lead leaching into the water supply at higher than legal limits. Lead exposure is especially dangerous for young children and pregnant women. Lead exposure can also lead to miscarriages and future developmental problems in children. In national news, newly released documents from the National Security Agency shows that, despite denials from the NSA and the White House, Edward Snowden had both face-to-face and email conversations with his superiors about what he considered to be illegal actions by the NSA. The story was broken by Vice News from documents received